Welcome to the Packet Pushers Podcast, a show about data networking. And if you've been listening to the show, you know that we talk about things like TCP/IP and data center networking and software-defined networking and anything that's dealing with moving packets from one side of the world to the other side of the world. We talk about that here. And this is another in a series I've entitled Design and Build, where we talk about projects and new things that you might be taking on in your network. And today's topic is dual stack IPv4, IPv6. You've got an IPv4 network. You're adding IPv6 to it. What does that look like? What are the operational considerations? What are some of the concerns that you would have as you introduce IPv6, which seems pretty timely? Aaron, the American Registry for Internet Names and Numbers, is really very close at this point. We're recording this on the 27th of June, 2015, just about out of IPv4 address space, finally. They announced they were down to their last /8, and they've been burning through addresses very quickly, as I think everybody realized it was just that real, and they're going like hotcakes. My name is Ethan Banks, at EC Banks on Twitter. You can follow me there. This is the Packet Pushers Podcast, which you can follow at Packet Pushers or visit at packetpushers.net. And let's introduce our guests. First up, we've got Guilherme Goes, who hails from Brazil. Would you introduce yourself and then pronounce your name correctly, because I'm fairly sure I didn't get it right.
Yes, and that's close enough. It's Guilherme Goes. Well, right now I'm the network team lead for a major sports event that will be going on in Brazil and next year. I'm coordinating the deployment of the results network for that event, where we carry out the results, the data, all the way from the timing scoring systems, all the way to the internet, to the broadcast providers, and so on. I'm CCIE 43725, and I'm glad to join you guys today.
Great. Thanks for coming on. And also with us is Jeff Carroll.
Good morning. My name is Jeff Carroll, and you can find me at JeffCarroll_V6 on Twitter. And I'm a network consultant, spent a lot of time in IPv6 and other networking activities as well. Been playing in the V6 world for a little over 5 years, and one of those having a good time with the technology.
Yeah, and I know you came up to Interop and did a little speaking on V6. You do some training and so on in that world. So, you know, if you've got 5 years in it, that's more than many folks, and we're glad you've come aboard.
Thanks very much.
Just as a little side note before we get into the show, you were just at the SharkFest conference, weren't you?
Yes, we just wrapped up SharkFest Thursday, 3 days of what everybody would think of as Wireshark all day long, but it's about technologies, it's about how to use Wireshark, it's talking about developing. I did a presentation about looking at IPv6-related packets inside of Wireshark, you know, setting up filters and things like that, but there was sessions on all kinds of different just technologies in general.
Cool. I saw you tweet about that, and I was thinking that I don't even know that I knew there was a SharkFest conference, because there's so many conferences, it's hard to keep track of them all, but I heard about that one, and that's, I think I want to go. So maybe next year I can make it out there. Sounds like a fun one.
Absolutely. They've been going on for 7 years, and it's really interesting. If you do a search engine search on SharkFest, there's actually two events. They're both out in the Bay Area. One's related to Wireshark, the protocol. The other is swimming with the fishies. So it's kind of fun. You might not get signed up for the right Wireshark if you're not paying attention, or SharkFest.
Well, all right. Let's hop into our conversation about IPv4, IPv6, and dual stack. And I think we need to level set here and start with a definition of what dual stack really is. So Jeff, let me maybe ask you to set the stage here. What is IPv4, IPv6, dual stack?
Dual stack is basic meaning of they're both independent, separate protocols. They have enough similarities. In fact, I usually tell people everything you know about IPv4 has a counterpart in IPv6, but about 50% of the time it's called something different. So everything that we know of from V4 at the base is all the way up through routing protocols has a counterpart. So in order to run V6, it's not one of those that you can just kind of flip another bit and enable V6 right there on top of your V4. It actually is a side-by-side. So that's where you get the dual stack, a dual protocol stack.
Mm. This reminds me of back in the day before TCP/IP was ubiquitous. We would run pretty commonly AppleTalk, IPX, and TCP/IP, and then maybe even something else in there, one of the DEC protocols, let's say, on the network, and the routers needed to support that, and sometimes hosts had multiple stacks configured, and that was a common thing back in the day, and then eventually it faded out, and TCP/IP took over everywhere.
Those were the days. Oh, my lovely. I remember my first internship job when we had to deploy some novel network servers with IPX and IPv4. Oh, I don't miss that at all. Good Lord.
No, EIGRP was my routing protocol of choice at the time. It could handle IP, certainly IPX and IP. Boy, I don't. Did it also do it? No, I think AppleTalk maybe was its own unique stack. I've forgotten. That's going back a long ways now. But yeah, boy. So now it's IPv4 and IPv6. Here's another question here. Would we define this as a migration strategy or a coexistence strategy? I mean, are IPv4 and IPv6 kind of like ships in the night, and eventually IPv4 is just going to fade away and we'll be running IPv6 everywhere? Or, I mean, what's the future look like?
Well, I don't believe it's a migration strategy, because IPv4 will stay with us for a long, long, long time. Because most of our legacy applications, like an internal custom build of something, of an ERP system or a house build application, that nobody wants to touch it anymore, nobody wants to have the effort to migrate the internal bits to IPv6, and that one will stay for us forever, and we need to fade away somehow. What we can do is try to do some kind of proxies in front of it or something like this. That's what I believe, at least.
Hmm. Jeff, what are you seeing as you talk to folks?
Well, I basically can confer. It's not really a migration. It's going to be coexisting, and I think there'll be portions of networks that could potentially convert, as it were, or, you know, completely turn off their V4. But just like Jeremy says, it's going to depend on applications largely. But it's coming down to a point that people at least could consider that. You know, if their applications support V6, then they could, quote, go with a single protocol. But it's starting to be maybe time of thinking of at least that coexistence and how that world is going to look for people.
I think it's good to point out something that Jeff, we know Ed Horley, he's pointed out in some of his presentations, is that if you don't think you're running IPv6 on your network today as a network engineer, reality is you are, because certainly for Microsoft Windows, it's the choice of the operating system to use IPv6 first when it can. And so there is definitely, if you put Wireshark out there and just observe what's going on, there's plenty of IPv6 frames in a given layer 2 broadcast domain.
Exactly. I'll ask people in seminars, say, you know, how many people are running V6 in your networks? And then I add on purpose. And that's when people start to think, it's like all modern day operating systems for at least the last almost 6 years have had V6 enabled as a default. And then, like you say, it's even more specifically for Windows platforms, is that it's the preferred protocol.
So you've got IPv6. It's there. So in a certain sense, you've got operating systems that are dual stacked, even though your network may not be. And that's why I said layer 2 broadcast domain initially, because if you haven't turned IPv6 routing services on, then you're not moving IPv6 between segments. You don't have an address plan in place, et cetera. And so maybe that's the next part of our conversation here is, let's say we want to start planning for a dual stack environment and actually taking control of the IPv6 you've already got and then intentionally moving your IPv6 around in your network. So let's start with some considerations here. Let's put a scenario out there that I've heard of. One common IPv6 deployment strategy you've got is IPv6 at the edge. So we're not talking about IPv6 everywhere yet, but we're talking about IPv6 at the edge. And then, Jalermi, you mentioned a proxy or NAT maybe to handle IPv6 to IPv4 translation. Is that strategy where maybe you've got IPv6 coming in from the internet then hitting some kind of a translation box on your network to IPv4 inside, is that good enough for the long term? Do we even need dual stack throughout the whole network?
Well, I don't believe it's good enough for the long run, but it's a starting point. You really can't start saying that you're going to have a project to deploy IPv6 everywhere in 2 years. It's not feasible for most networks. What you're going to do is, well, pick and choose. Start with the core or start with the network edge and work towards the rest of the network as well. Just the network edge is a really big project. It depends on the size of your enterprise. But you got to pick and choose. You can't just try to handle everything at once. That would be crazy.
And by starting at the edge, we're again, we're getting at, you've got an IPv6 capable link to the internet, you've got some kind of address space assigned to you, and you're advertising some services that people are coming to consume from you via IPv6. That traffic comes in, hits, probably goes through a firewall for inspection perhaps, and then is going to hit a load balancer. And this is one of the most common scenarios I've seen. The load balancer will serve up a virtual IPv6 address, but then it's actually load balancing to IPv4 on the back end hosts. So it's IPv6 out to the client, IPv4 to the servers inside. Either you guys had experience with that kind of a scenario and have some comments?
Well, I'll go ahead and comment that. I think that is certainly maybe a first initial way of doing it, but it doesn't mean it. I would say has to be, of course. You can still have dual stack on the back end, or you can be like one of those other big monster content serving companies that starts with an F, good old Facebook. They're doing V6 totally in the data centers now and no V4.
Ah.
So they're kind of doing, went to the almost opposite model where they do the load balancing of V4, V6 inbound. And then on the back end, it's all V6.
Now, Facebook, I'm going to guess, has some unique challenges with address space because of their size, or do you happen to know what their motivations were to go purely V6 in the data center?
I think it was related to size and addressing and the challenges that they were having using private addressing and NAT.
As I've heard of this with, I believe, Microsoft as well, where the RFC 1918 private address space was simply insufficient to meet their addressing needs. And so, well, fine, let's just go to IPv6 and be done with it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just almost that pure and simple. But they still have to serve a V4 world. And so that's why, you know, that load balancer and using, even with technology, the NAT64, DNS64, at least give the capability of having either single stack coming in or dual stack coming in.
Mm. And one thing that guys really shouldn't take care of is that your V6 deployment should be as good as your V4 deployment. You can't skip on that because... imagine the guys from Asia Pacific, where there's plenty of deployments of V6 there, and those guys will prefer to use your V6 connection, not your V4. And if you have some problem with your V6 deployment, you're gonna cut those guys out of your service that you're providing. So that could be a big problem for some companies.
Mm. Yeah, sounds like what we're saying here is edge deployment is a good place to start. You know, long term, you really are going to want IPv6 everywhere in your network. But you don't have to do it all at once. You're going to start somewhere. Start off with a bite-sized chunk, and then push IPv6 further in. Most likely for the average engineer that's listening to this, they don't run a Facebook size network. They're running, we're running something much smaller, servicing anything from, 1,000 people to, even 20,000 people would still be considered reasonably small. Not huge data centers where the address space is the big consideration, but it would be a phased approach. The edge serving the internet would be a logical place to start, and then work in from there, putting dual stack throughout the environment. So okay, I'm committed now. I'm an engineer who's going to, work with the business who is also committed. Hopefully those are, we're in lockstep and in agreement here. How do I go about evaluating my network equipment capability for IPv6? Is there a strategy that I should follow? Is there a, how do I go about making sure that my network gear has got the ability to carry IPv6?
Well, I think one of the things is just the easy enough checkbox of, does it support? And again, it's one of those you can say in the last 5-6 years that probably most infrastructure gear will support. Even stuff that I have in my lab is 10 years old supports V6. But then you have to start getting a little bit deeper, say, well, just giving an address may not be the only thing I have to deal with. What are all of the other services? Even from a simple, what can you use a V6 time server? I've got some gear that can't even do that, and it's a relatively new product, and it can't even ask a V6 time server for time. You have to do that on V4. And then there's all the other things about, is it software bound, especially from a routing perspective, software or hardware. in its operation. And so there tends to be a lot of questions at the infrastructure level that actually need to be asked, not just the simple, can I enable V6 on an interface or can I enable a V6 routing protocol?
Right, because so, there's two pieces and parts there. There's one, the device itself and its ability to forward IPv6, which again, that's one thing that you can, it's probably there, you can probably do it, it's been there for a long time, that element of it. But, well, Jeff, as you were saying, you know, geez, I can't get NTP services over V6. I have to do that over V4. Well, yeah, it reminds me of, you know, VRFs, the same kind of scenario. Can I actually request this service over some isolated management VRF that I've requested or not? And it depended a lot in the Cisco world anyway on what particular version of iOS is running on the box. So yeah, the same, you got forwarding concerns, data plane concerns, and then you got control plane concerns as well to consider. Not that all of those things are necessarily showstoppers, but you get to this point of, right, making your checklist, what things are key, what things are important, and then, you know, moving ahead. And it's far more than simply, you know, addressing and its capability to forward IPv6. Now, there's also performance concerns too here, right?
But the one thing that I really wanted to stress out is that don't just believe in the white papers and the spec sheets. If you have the time, please try to lab it out, because you can find pretty nasty surprises on those nice shiny boxes. Because, well, even if you take a look at some recent release notes for some products, you're going to see, oh, we just added support for IPv6 in the latest version. Is it good enough? Is it stable enough? How much test has gone on through that feature? It's better to check it out in a lab if you are able to. It make your life, you're going to sleep better in the night with that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, there's thousands of people listening with this big old grin on their face because we've all been there before. Yeah, that's, yes. actually that dovetails nicely into the question I asked, you know, and overspoke you there, but performance is a thing. I don't know with modern silicon how much we've caught up here, but certainly with older platforms, your forwarding performance of V4 versus V6 could be different. It's a 32-bit address space versus 128-bit address space, and the silicon can't necessarily pump the traffic through at the same rate of speed. So that's another one of those things you need to keep in the back of your mind.
Well, and not only even that, I've discovered in some of these products that when you implement or enable the V6 capability, that they actually steal resources from the V4. So the the amount of address space that you had, or the amount of routing tables that it could, or route entries it could support in the route table, actually decrease because they have to allocate. And then, like you say, the address sizing is so much larger that you get fewer V6, memory components than you have for V4.
I would assume that's TCAM allocation that's probably going on there.
Yeah.
Again, another one of those things to be digging into. And of course, this is going to vary widely by a router or switch platform versus a firewall versus a load balancer. And so you have concerns at different parts of the forwarding stack as you look at different classes of equipment that you might be responsible for. Okay, your firewall supports IPv6. What does that really mean? You got to dig in and sort that out. Same thing with load balancers and so on. You know, for example, F5 load balancers have been really good at dealing with V6, V4 translation and giving you a lot of capabilities there. And I would say that, but it's going to depend on what version you are running of Big IP. You need to, because it changes significantly in more features and functions as you go through the different code revisions. So
the thing is, if you're already pushing your box to the limits with just IPv4, well, don't try to enable IPv6 on that, because you're going to, well, exhaust their resources pretty easily and you not get deliver a pretty experience to your customers. So take care of that. Do a baseline first, see how much you are really using the resource of your boxes right now, and just not try to deploy IPv6 in parallel of IPv4 in the same boxes that are already stressed out, because, well, that's not good.
Well, that's actually a really good segue into another question that I've got, which is, if my box is busy with IPv4 already, let's talk about the control plane specifically. Is there a lot of extra burden that goes in lighting up V6 routing protocols, let's say? Does that really hit the CPU hard in the box? What's the memory overhead, and you know, and so on? Jeff, you got any take on that?
Well, I think that's that is the question more than anything else, because it does depend on platform, versions of code. It might even be to those things that, yes, the box can do it, but will it perform? Even as Guilherme said, of running testing, it actually in the lab scenarios to do what I would consider the stress testing, or the worst case scenario for your environment testing, because those things are going to react a little bit differently. I think that at some minimal levels, the hardware may not have as much of a problem, but it probably ramps up a little quicker, a little bit more of an exponential looking chart of load factor and performance. It's just because things are so much bigger. Yeah, the address is just so much bigger.
Mm. Okay, so let's move ahead into some more practical aspects here. I mean, we understand that we've got a lot of work to do in evaluating our network equipment, not just the equipment itself, but also the operating system version, what its capabilities are, and that we need to consider the extra load we're going to place on the system by lighting up IPv6 to do forwarding and processing and so on. Okay, let's say we've gotten past that. And now we need to start thinking about IPv6 address planning. Okay. Now, a lot of people that look into IPv6 address space look at it, and they're initially a little overwhelmed. It's a huge address space, 128 bits, and there are so many addresses in some of the blocks that get assigned. You can't mentally, as a human being, it's very difficult to comprehend just how large that address space is. But yet, we all come from an IPv4 background where we're used to being very conservative and very tight with our address space and being very diligent and careful about how we do our address planning. But one of the things that I've learned digging into IPv6 is because there is so much address space, you kind of have to take your IPv4 subnetting mindset, and to a point, you just kind of chuck it out the window, and you're going to waste a lot of address space within the IPv6 world, and that's completely okay. Now, Jeff, I'm sure if you've been dealing with this for 5 years, you've seen several iterations of address planning. And these days, what are you recommending to people as they do their subnet plans?
Well, the first thing is take the word waste and purge it from your consciousness. You know, purge it from the vocabulary, because the waste looks like just what you're commenting about. We've been so conservative for so many years in our V4 address usage, so you can't go there. The second piece is, it's like everything else. It's when you kind of understand some of the foundation use of the addressing, it becomes a little bit easier to grasp. So it's one of those, it takes a little bit to getting into it to get to that point of understanding. And the third probably component is, most people aren't going to readdress their network for V6, I would say, differently from their V4. There's things like, you can have a much larger layer 2 broadcast domain with V6, but we're not going to do that because we're probably going to have V4. So we're going to have to live with that piece of it. And so it's kind of, everybody looks at that and goes, well, I've got a /64 subnet, which yields 18 billion billion and change possible unique host IDs. And so we're going to put this on our 200-node network. We're going to have all those 18 billion billion addresses left. That's wasting. And that's where we say, no, it's not wasting. It's just the way it's designed more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I think to speak to your earlier point there, I mean, you're saying if you've got an IPv4 layer 3 segment, you're probably going to have an IPv6 layer 3 segment that matches, even though you're burning out just quote unquote wasting a bunch of addresses that you're never going to use, and that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even the other piece I have to tell people. It's not even an okay. That's the way it's designed. People will say, well, then I'll just chunk my /64 and make even much smaller subnets so I don't waste those addresses. Well, the problem is most operating systems won't even operate to that point. They don't allow you to change the mask, the CIDR-looking mask, from something smaller than a /64 at an endpoint network. So when you kind of understand that, one, you're following the rule, and two, the manufacturers are also following the rule, then you start going, well, okay, it's not wasting. It's just there's a lot of extra addresses.
Mm. And my understanding on the typical subnet boundaries in IPv6 is you're subnetting on the nibble boundary of the address. Is that, do I have a correct perception there?
Well, we'll just say it's much easier math if you do that. There's nothing that says you can't take a particular address scheme and only stick on the nibble, because you could have quote unquote fewer subnets that way. So you can break it up off of the nibble boundary, but if you keep it at the nibble, you still have so much flexibility, and your math, your calculation, and looking at that address immediately, kind of understanding what it is, becomes much, much easier. You don't have to literally dig out the calculator and the whiteboard just to figure out, what does this slash 57 mean? How many networks do I get on a slash 57? And that's kind of like an off-the-nibble boundary.
I mean, what is the nibble boundary then? Why don't you go ahead and define that? Just I realized I threw that out and didn't say what it was.
Well, fair point. So in the V6 context of 128-bit, it's broken up at every 16 bits, and then the delimiter is a colon. Each 4 bits of a 16-bit grouping, and we call that a hextet, each 4 bits of the 16 is a nibble. So you've got 4 nibbles within a hextet. Mm. So that's how we're taking care of the nibble boundary. It's every 4-bit boundary.
Got it. So let's take an example here. Now, I would be used to numbering a point-to-point link between routers that's used just for transiting traffic with a slash 30, maybe even a slash 31 in IPv4. How would I number that, considering waste is no longer in my vocabulary? How would I number that in IPv6?
Well, you have two options. The original was you would still assign it a slash 64. The security concern is there a ping pong attack with 18 billion addresses. So there is the capability in the RFCs to say you could do a slash 127, which gives you two addresses. The unfortunate part about it is not all of the layer 3 vendor code supports that, because the ::0 is the same as the anycast address. And I was literally just playing with this yesterday while I was out the airport on my remote network trying some other options. And I've got different products in my lab, and one of them doesn't support it even with their latest code of 2 months ago. Hmm. So it's not that you have to be able to do the 127, but that's the best practice for that point-to-point link if you can, if you're product that you have in place does support that capability. Otherwise, you'd still assign it as a slash 64, and then you just need to control with, say, router ACLs to make sure that no other addresses can be used within that point-to-point link.
Hmm. Guilherme, a question for you, as you've been digging into IPv6 for your own network, how have you considered the address space? I mean, do you want your own address space, or are you okay getting an address space allocation from your provider? I guess I'm really curious about the provider independent space, and I ask it in this context. As I've looked into getting IP address space, IPv6 address space, I still have to perform a justification. Aaron is not going to just give me an IPv6 block because I asked and paid the fee. They still want a similar kind of a justification like I would have had to make for IPv4, where I'm dual homed and need to advertise the same address space out from multiple locations. Okay, that's a valid justification, et cetera. And it seems like the idea there is, well, if we have all these companies getting their own IPv6 address space, we're going to have an address, routing table explosion in the internet like we've had with IPv4. So wouldn't it be better if companies just got address space assigned to them by the providers so we can have more summarization and keep the routing table under control? And yet, I really want my own IPv6 address space. It seems, better in my frame of mind. And Guilherme, have you into that? Do you have an opinion?
For me, that's pretty easy question, because if you don't get your own PI space, you won't be able to migrate from one provider to the other easily, because you're not just talking about the internet edge anymore. We don't have a net on V6. Imagine you have to readdress all your point-to-point links, all your internal LAN, just because you changed your internet-facing provider. It would be pretty troublesome to do that. So For me, it's pretty clear. If you are able to, you should really, really, really go with a PI space. Because with that, it will make your life simpler in the long run. Without it, if you just change your internet-facing links, you may need to re-address your internal LAN, and it will be pretty a lot of wasted effort with that. So for the most, the biggest companies have already BGP with their internet-facing links and have their own address space. It's not so tough to request a V6 address blocks from those, and you get, depend on the size of a company, /32 or /48, depend on the size of the company, and you can work with that and even planning a global addressing scheme. But for me, it's not feasible to don't have a PI space. You can go with a private address space, but that will not end up pretty well for my taste. What do you think, Jeff?
Fundamentally agree, and it's interesting, at least from our perspective in North America, going to Aaron to get V6. It's actually a little bit easier to get V6 addressing, certainly now, than it is V4. But even a few years ago, it was easier. Even for my own needs, I have small labs as far as equipment count, you know, small amount of devices. Yet I was talking with some Aaron folks at one of the V6 conferences last year and asking, you know, can I, from a training perspective, get like a /40 address block, which is just, you know, would be more than a lot of enterprises would get. But my initial idea was from a training and being able to do different address configuration scenarios. And they're like, oh, yeah, no problem. So even for companies going and getting addresses, it's not actually that hard to do for almost any size entity. The biggest component is they would like you to be, you know, peered from multiple points more than anything else. But they're making it a little bit easier from that perspective to get it. And just like Guilherme said, changing providers, we all know what that's like when we have to go change our public-facing, you know, V4 addresses. Since most people from the inside addressing perspective have been doing the private addresses, it wasn't quite so much of a big deal. And again, like Guilherme says, there's no reason to try to use that dedicated V6 private address area, because there's no official NAT that would get you from that private to the public. There are companies that have that technology, but there's just no real reason to do it. You could put public addresses everywhere and, you know, have the appropriate firewall and router rules in place to block that. But if you change providers, then you have to do a complete readdressing. Now, from even that perspective, at least V6 has some technologies in place or some components in its design that allow for a much easier readdressing action than, say, what we had in the V4 world. So it's like my base recommendation to just about everybody is, if you've got the right, call it physical layer to the internet capability, then going and getting a private address block is the right and easiest way to go. That way you don't have to deal with anything from your internet provider other than your base connection.
Mm-hmm. And just one thing that I would like to put for our secure folks out there, a NAT is not a viable security feature. You won't get NAT with V6, and don't get me even started on that, please.
Yeah, ditto.
Yeah, I've blogged about this in the past, too, that obfuscation is not security by any definition. Yeah. It can help, and some people are going, oh, NAT's really important to me, and so on and so on. But, yeah, get rid of that mindset when you move to IPv6. There's not a... Now, just for clarification, I mean, there are NAT technologies within IPv6, but what you're saying is there's not a generally accepted NAT practice to NAT66, I would say, that would take you from some private IPv6 address block to some publicly routed IPv6 address block.
And we are already faced this in our current V4 deployments. How many troubles NAT gave us with IPv4? If we can't start fresh new with and get rid of that, life will be easier for everybody. Yep. Try to have that mindset.
Yes, NAT breaks all the things, and service providers that are dealing with needing to support IPv4 endpoints are going to carrier-grade NAT, where there's an initial NAT and then there's a regional NAT, and that is not fun. I read an article that the guys from the Microsoft Xbox team posted talking about how a lot of the functionality within the Xbox Live gaming system gets broken in carrier-grade NAT scenarios because there's an expectation of being able to communicate one-to-one. When you're NATing and then NATing again with IPv4, you can't make that work. All right, we got to move on, guys. There's more stuff we want to talk about here. Let's talk about this. What are some common mistakes that a new dual stacker might make? You're a network engineer, you're deploying dual stack. Is there something, Jeff, that I should be thinking about that I am likely to be screwing up my first time out with this technology?
You know, it's kind of like I would say not necessarily. I think the biggest concern is that if the, like we had commented earlier, if let's say the devices that are doing the routing, any of the layer three components, it's just validating that they support the protocols. For instance, every routing protocol we know of today has a V6 counterpart. So if you're running OSPF, there's OSPF V3, version 3, that supports IPv6. Then the question becomes, how much support for OSPF V3 does the routing platform have? Or if you're an EIGRP shop, there's EIGRP V6. So again, does your Cisco layer 3 switch or router support that fully? Probably from the aspect of the, I would call it that forward facing, is even into BGP, making sure that the BGP you're running, you can go up to the newer version known as MPBGP. So I haven't really seen any other, I would say, major issues. If there's been just enough research to make sure that the infrastructure supports it, everything else becomes the common things of, oh, I didn't break my V6 addresses up the way I probably should have. But other than that, it just kind of works.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about that. I mean, do I need to carefully plan my subnets from a summarization standpoint? I mean, do those best practices still hold like they did with IPv4?
Yes.
So nothing changes there. I still need to have a an intelligent addressing plan. It may encompass lots more addresses within a subnet, but I still need to plan intelligently. I can still do summarization of IPv6 routes on my segment boundaries and regional boundaries and so on. And keeping control of your routing table is still a good and intelligent thing to do for all the reasons that it was good in IPv4. You might even have more flexibility now with an IPv6 to do to make addresses that are recognizable to you and so on.
Exactly.
Just speaking in recognizable addresses, for one mistake that guys could make is trying to use Excel as your IPAN tool for V6. It doesn't even work all that great for V4, but for V6, it's a pipe dream to try to use the Excel as your IPAN tool for that. Just,
in other words, you need a real IPAM solution. A spreadsheet just doesn't cut it.
Yeah, and there's plenty of even open source alternatives that are good enough for most guys.
Do you happen to have an IPAM platform that you're happy with that you could recommend?
Currently, we are using PHP IPAM. It's it's working fine for us. It's good enough.
Mm-hmm. And then that sounds like an open source platform then? I haven't actually heard of that one.
Yeah, it's an open source one. It's freely available on the internet. You can just Google for it. It's pretty easy to install, easy to run. It's okay.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess that's kind of another, as a side note, that's something we didn't mention, but does your network management platform and whatever the peripheral tools you use to manage your network, do they support IPv6 as well? Mm-hmm. I know some companies have run into that as a problem, that they've been using X whatever platform for a long time, and it turns out they couldn't enter an IPv6 address into this system if they wanted to because it was never designed with that in mind. So yet another part of your evaluation process. Well, let's move the conversation ahead another step and talk about address assignment. Now, we're very used to DHCP from the IPv4 background, and I know there's a DHCP V6, but there are other address assignment methodologies that you can use within IPv6. I mean, Jeff, have we settled on one? Does the use case for an address assignment choice depend on scenario, or have we kind of settled on one way to do it?
Well, it's bits and pieces. I would say folks that are used to doing DHCP in, let's just say, endpoint networks will probably follow suit. with a V6 platform using DHCP V6. We do have some challenges, though, that not all operating systems support that. For instance, Android doesn't support DHCP V6 right now. So your only choice there is to use one of the other options like Slack, stateless address auto configuration, where it's not statically entered and it's not from a server. It's a combination of what the router provides to clients in what's known as the router advertisement. And clients pick up a network prefix and compute their own node ID. I don't see that the Slack being, I would say, the new predominant. I think it still has validity in certain parts of a network, certain maybe segments, but I think by and large, DHCP V6 is going to be used because everybody knows it and it's comfortable. And we could have a whole session on DHCP V6 because it has a lot of different operational aspects than what V4 does. So there perhaps is sometimes a little challenge in DHCP V6 management as well.
Jeremy, have you run into this as a concern of yours?
Yes, as Jeff said, not every single client supports DHCP V6. And the things I face with Slack is some privacy considerations, because if your endpoint always computes the same host address for with the same address, a attacker could track you when you move from your home to your company and so on. So we can, there's some new RFC. Actually, it's not so new. It's came out in 2007. RFC 4941 suggests new ways of recycling or cycling the host part of your address so that you have more or less a random host address. But for me, Slack is good enough for most things. But there's some things like how could you get your boot server? How would you get your DNS servers that DHCP V6 could help you with? So if you got to do an assessment and see if the clients you're supporting support V6. If they do, please go with V6. It will make your life easier. But if they don't, we'll need to run both Slack and DHCP V6 on the same links. Depends on your environment and the clients you're supporting.
Now, many of us that are in IPv4 environments will use DHCP for hosts that we're not terribly concerned about what their address is, but habitually a lot of environments will statically assign IPv4 addresses to things like servers. Do you still statically assign addresses to servers, or do you use Slack or DHCP?
Statically.
I'll favor the other way. Try to start relying more on DNS. Try to use using dynamic IP addresses and registering this with your DNS server. I think that makes your operation easier and gives more flexibility in the end.
But Jeff, you're saying a lot of shops are doing statically?
Yeah, and I think it's part of that old school way. You know, right now, I would say the larger majority of network professionals, whether they're engineers, architect, technicians, and everything in between, probably have only ever played with IPv4. They haven't had that luxury of playing with the older protocols when we had, at that point then, multiple protocol stacks running. So to layer in or to bring in V6 in a dual stack world now, they're going to try to make everything as easily mapped and functions and operation to their V4 world. So most people are still, at least that I come across, are saying, yeah, anything that we statically assign today, especially in the data center, you know, your servers and all those type of resources, they're probably going to go ahead and do the same. Other devices that may be, I'd say, out at the edge, but that are kind of static in their operation, like printers, things like that, maybe they do DHCP V6 with reservations. You know, so at least it's still always the same address, but it's not statically or manually assigned. And that way just keeps everything, that's how they do it with V4, they do the same thing with V6, and from a procedural standpoint, it doesn't change much.
But just because I've done it that way right along, is that the best way to do it? Because I guess I tend to go with Jeremy's point of view in that just start relying on DNS for these things more, because that is a lot of address space to be typing out.
Yeah, imagine you try to ping a V6 address and you remember those addresses. It's crazy. It's not feasible, not in my mind at least. Because it's easy enough to ping 10.1.1.1. But try to remember, oh, it's 2001, DB8, 123, ABC, and so on. It's not very feasible to remember all those IP addresses. So... well, start relying on your tools. Start relying on DNS. It's a pretty established protocol, and people should start relying on those more. Mm.
So here's another question in the context of planning for dual stack, and that is choosing an ISP. Now, this is kind of an interesting question here. Do I dual stack my public internet link? Do I run a dedicated IPv6 link? Do I run a tunnel over the top of my IPv4 to connect to a provider? There's pros and cons to all of these things. I mean, the overlay tunnel seems like a last resort sort of an approach, like connecting to Hurricane Electric with their tunnel broker service, because I don't get IPv6 from my provider. Are there strategies or best practices here for choosing a link?
Well, North America, in the U.S., the problem is most providers aren't giving V6, certainly not at the home connection level, and even at small, medium business level. I have two different business-grade accounts from different providers where I live, one at my home office and one at my office, and neither one of them give me V6. So it's not even that I get a choice. I would love it if I could get it. I would do it, but I can't.
I'm in the same boat right now. I can't get V6 in my home office either. Yeah.
So it's not even we can't even put it into the issue of which is the best way. Again, now this is North America, and it's not all the providers in North America in the U.S., but it's a larger majority. Different parts of the world, it's absolutely different. Sometimes better, sometimes not any better. So I think we're still in the boat of, if you can get native V6, then dual stack. If you can't, then you're going to use one of the what is considered transition technology, some type of tunnel service, and that's what I do. I've got different types of tunnels to different, even different tunnel providers. So it's V6 over V4 tunnel.
Now, let's say choosing IPv6 wasn't the concern. I've got IPv6. I can get it. Is there any merit to dedicating a particular link to be IPv6 only traffic?
The only reason I can think about is, well, measuring your operational-wise, so we can have better handle that. But I really don't see the operational use case for that. If you are able to, please go do a stack on your internet face links. I think it will be make your life easier. And you always need to think about your budget. It will be really tough to convince your boss to dedicate a V6, just a internet face link just for V6, even if you don't even know how many guys will use that. So the most practical option, the most realistic option, is to run dual stack on your internet facing if you are able to.
Okay, so what services could I then provide across that link? One thought that I had is, how viable is it if I've got an IPv6 connection coming into my company to provide layer 3 VPN service for my clients to come back and connect to me over V6? Is that viable if I've got a globally distributed workforce that they can connect back to me over V6 at this point?
Depends on the software. A lot of the tunnel and VPN software for clients is not V6 enabled yet.
Really? It's 2015 and that is still a big concern.
Yes.
That is a depressing answer.
That's my comment. It's the middle of the second decade of the 21st century, and V6 has been available for 16 years. It's been much more available in the last 5, 6, 7 years, from a global internet perspective, and yet we're still talking about applications that aren't converted. And like you were talking about being at Interop, and one of my things is just go around to the vendors, anybody that provided service or applications, do you support V6? And by and large, vendors are saying, well, no, because nobody's asking for it.
I have had that same experience. I get briefed by a lot of vendors with new products because they're in the startup. They're a startup of some kind, and I'll ask them. I'm trying to make it a habit to ask every single one of them, what's your IPv6 support? And I get the same thing. Well, no one's asking for it, so we're not doing it. It's like, come on, guys, chicken or the egg, you know?
But
you guys got
to
lead this.
I do believe that that's our role to start pushing this. If we the network engineers, doesn't push for this, well, we won't get this. People will get stuck on this. Even though we don't have IPv4 anymore, but well, then we're going to start using crazy solutions like carrier grade NAT that's terrible, as we already discussed it. And another point on the same topic about services, for the service provider, it's not only about just saying, oh, okay, I'll give you a V6-enabled link. They also have to provide DNS service for that. And what about the other services that your provider provides you? Like, well, what about my MPLS VPNs, my MPLS clouds? Will that be V6-enabled or not? What about the other services? You have to have a look at that, too.
Absolutely.
One service that we've hinted around but haven't really parked and talked about very much is DNS. When I'm running a dual-stack environment, DNS becomes kind of important. Jeff, do you have a specific recommendation for how folks deal with their DNS once they bring IPv6 into the environment?
Well, I guess the thing is, as soon as they bring it in, that everything that they're providing, so if they're forward-facing content servers, are going to be dual-stacked. And, of course, you've got to enter in all your appropriate DNS quad A records. And then as soon as you're doing things on the inside, the same thing. And then we have to even say on services, and maybe not so many people are running some of the older server platforms, but like Windows 2003 server can be a dual-stacked platform, but none of its applications support it. So even its DNS didn't support V6, didn't support Quad A records. If somebody's running bind servers, it's not so much of an issue. Probably anything, again, in the last 5 or 6 years from a services viewpoint they can get. But I don't think a lot of people forget the DNS piece. They seem to kind of understand that one pretty quick. At least after they try it the first time, it doesn't work, and it's like, okay, who told the DNS guy to put the entries in, right?
Now, there's when you put in a Quad A record, my understanding is a lot of the RFCs have been have kind of come together such that when IPv6 is available to a host, it's going to prefer IPv6 as a choice, and one of the things it's going to do is query for a particular host name via Quad A. Hey, can I resolve this to an IPv6 address, and then we'll go forth from there. Do I understand that about right?
Yeah, pretty much. And in fact, even some of the updates, like if you update, say, Windows 7 clients, if V6 is enabled, then even when it asks questions to do a resolve, it'll actually ask both in V4 and V6, and in both queries, it asks for Quad A and A records. So you could actually V6 communicate to a DNS, but you ask two questions, and you may get a resolve in both. But if V6 isn't routed out, then it actually would flip back to V4, but it found it out through the V6 transport. It's actually very interesting to see all the packets, and it really confuses network folks right off the bat when they start seeing what looks like redundant traffic. But it's all related to RFC 6555, known as happy eyeballs. It's part of the use, end user usage of a dual stacked world. So lots of things go with that, but it's all related to DNS as the foundation operation.
And if you dig back through the Packet Pushers archives, we did do a show on happy eyeballs, but it's been a while. I don't remember the show number off the top of my head, but if you dig through, you can find that if you want to learn more about happy eyeballs and what that's all about and how that works. Okay, so let's move into a bit about operations, which we've talked about before, that when you add IPv6 to your network, there may be some impact to your operations. One of those things we briefly mentioned earlier, which is managing network devices. Now, Guilherme, I'm wondering if you considered managing your infrastructure over V6. Is that interesting to you? And if so, is that even a viable option considering what your infrastructure is?
Well, it depends on, as you put that, Ethan, it depends on your what you're managing with. Because as Jeff said, there's even some service that we are in 2015 that is, still doesn't support V6. So my first option would just say, oh, try to run this on your data plane, and for the management plane of your devices, stick with V4, because most of guys are not enabled yet. And use DNS for the management addresses so that you, when you enable V6 on one of those boxes, you just use V6 automatically. Okay.
Have you found that any one vendor is better with this than others? Like, I don't know what all equipment you work with, but let's say Cisco and Juniper?
Because, well, as we know, Cisco is just a bunch of BUs stick together. That depends on the product lines you're working with. But most of the guys nowadays support V6, so I don't have a good opinion on this. Okay. Mm.
And Jeff, is there a strategy you see folks adopting regarding management? Do they try to get? I've just heard this in the past that it's one of the things that folks try to do is when they light up V6 is, I wonder if I can get my management network going on this, because it's kind of a nice place, kind of low risk to start as far as the overall environment goes.
Exactly. That's one of the things I was going to comment. I wouldn't say it's a best practice, but it appears to be a leaning practice where, as you say, I can put V6 in my infrastructure, but I don't have to run my, quote, production environments on it as a protocol. And so I can go ahead and start try to manage. As we've said, most of the infrastructure devices probably support V6. It becomes a little bit more key of what all tools and what all applications are you using for management. And that's where we run into, again, part of the problems that they, not all of them may have it. But it's a good strategy to get your feet wet, get the experience, and actually see, you know, all the different routing and performance, even on the boxes that V6 may have, with, again, your comment of low risk.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
low risk from a production,
yes,
let's say, problem, but high risk if I can't get to my box all of a sudden and I
exactly.
need to. Okay, that's a different story, right?
Yeah.
You know, we all think, or my perspective is, you know, the worst case scenario, can I at least still telnet to the box, right? And it's really interesting. When I first started playing with all of this stuff 5 years ago, it wasn't that the boxes didn't support V6. Is even my favorite telnet couldn't do it. My favorite TFTP couldn't do it. And so I even had to start finding newer versions or completely different applications. And even those low-level applications today are probably better, but it's still those very big, large management products that we buy that still don't have good V6 support.
Let's talk about some specific applications then kind of related to this. If I'm a shop that is highly secure and I'm worried about control plane policing, a lot of environments don't run control plane policing because it's too complex of a policy to configure. Others have very well-defined control plane policing for their V4 environments. If I want to run COP for V6, what's actually happening? Am I building out a whole second policy, or are there different considerations for that?
Well, I've not run it, but even just looking at the basic configuration, it looks like you'd have to run two separate, you know, definitions of it. It looks like it's all in its base configuration IPv4, and so I'd assume you'd have to have V6 counterparts.
Yeah, I mean, it's very complicated in IPv4 in the sense that what you're doing is throttling certain inputs into the system that are going to hit the control plane and affect that box's CPU. So you can control how much OSPF traffic is hitting the box, how much ICMP is hitting the box, and so on. There's lots and lots and lots of granularity you can get into with traffic rates and so on. Now with IPv6, we've got different sets of protocols in some places. And so, right, that is my understanding as well, Jeff. You stand up a second control plane policing policy that handles specifics for IPv6, and of course you have to tweak it to work right in your environment. Out of the box, there's no COP default that's going to work exactly right, because, you know, if you're too restrictive, you're going to impact your environment by throwing away traffic that you actually needed to keep your environment running like you want. And I'm presumably IPv6 is exactly the same, but I guess I'm just trying to raise the point here. If you are a control plane policing shop, you got to think about it all over again with IPv6.
Yeah, don't try to just reuse the same policies you have for before, because, well, maybe those are tuned for the V4 protocols, and the V6 protocols can work a little bit different, and the volume of messages and the packet size can be a little bit different, and then you could screw up with your boxes if you do it poorly.
Okay, another operational question then involves dual stack problems. I mean, are there common problems that we've run into? And then, if so, how do you troubleshoot those? Is there any unique tips and tricks that you guys might have for issues that arise?
Wireshark is your friend. I don't mean it to be flippant, but it's one of those things that there are differences in, I would say, some of the problems and some of the troubleshooting, and it largely depends on, actually, a little bit of two comments earlier about deploying, is that if you deploy but don't pay attention to the addressing operations, meaning in V6, there are ways for this automatic addressing that are keyed from these router advertisements that we don't have in V4. So you can actually have misconfigured router interfaces that tell the client to go ahead and get an address in an automatic way. That client could also have, say, a static or a DHCP address. Then they end up with multiple addresses. And then it's which address gets used by the client operating system. Mm-hmm. So it's a challenge. We've never had anything like that in V4 where an interface can have multiple host addresses in the same network prefix, and it's allowed, and it could be common, and we don't have that in V4. So the troubleshooting is, I'm going to troubleshoot using my DHCP address, but it's actually the client also has these automatic addresses, the privacy addresses, and that's the address that gets used. And so the next thing you know, you can never find where that client's talking anything because you're looking for the wrong address.
Mm-hmm.
Or the address changes, which is part of the privacy thing, is that address can change so that you can't be found. And you're going along and you're looking at an address, say a client server trace, and then it just stops. Yet the application is still working, and it's because the address automatically changed and you started using the new one.
That's hairy. I mean, my brain's thinking, how the heck would you actually track that down in Wireshark? Because, you just filter on MAC address. Not unless you're on the local segment of the host, you're not. Yeah,
right.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. So, there's challenges there. There's, I would say, generically, the only challenge is partly just learning the new words. So if we're used to any of the ICMP protocol uses, there's ICMP V6. So it's just that understanding that there are some things that are different and things that are new. And again, the troubleshooting, it by and large is I would say about the same, but it's a different address. And that's where, using Wireshark or some, packet analyzer, certainly makes that life much easier. I tell people when they're playing with V6 in the lab, they should be running Wireshark all the time. And trying to understand the communications that go on at a V6 level that are different than a V4.
Yeah, it's funny how amazingly helpful forcing yourself to do a packet-by-packet analysis can be, especially when it's in a controlled environment. It's overwhelming if you just put Wireshark onto your production environment and start just pulling things off the wire and trying to make sense of it all. But if you're in a lab environment where you've got just a few hosts or even just two hosts, and you analyze a communication between those two hosts, it's incredibly informative. I've been doing some of that with OpenFlow, just monitoring a connection between Mininet and a small open flow controller. Well, what happens when I put a packet between this host and Mininet and this other one, and it doesn't yet know how to do the forwarding, and then watching the interaction packet by packet between the open flow controller and Mininet? Incredibly informative, very detailed, but if you get it down to two hosts, you can get through the packet trace, and then you've got a baseline in your head of exactly what that communication is supposed to be, so that when you do go to the fire hose and you're seeing a lot of traffic, you can pick out the thread that you know should be there and wade through the information more effectively that way.
And another common problem that I have already seen in the lab is when you try to put an ACL saying with deny any in the bottom of it. Because if you don't put it on a Cisco router, at least, you have some implicit permits for some ICMP messages. Because we got to be aware that for V6, we rely much more on ICMP. And if you block those ICMP messages, well, the things don't work anymore. So take care. Have a look at your ACLs and don't try to build them as the same as you do for V4. Because maybe you are blocking some messages that you are relying on.
Excellent point. That's just awesome because that's probably a very common mistake. We were talking about what are the common mistakes that people make is that they'll try to match their ACLs. And as Guilherme said, you can't always exactly do that. You'll actually block core operations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. A key difference. Something that some of us are used to thinking about when dealing with firewalls for things like PathMTU, discovery, and this sort of thing, where you really need the ICMP message to go through, but yet habitually we block ICMP at firewalls. Even more critical within the V6 world, because as you say, there's a dependency on ICMP messaging within V6 for things to work. Well, since we brought up security, why don't we bring up a couple of security concerns here? They're like a best practice that if I'm deploying V6, I should really have these security items in place?
I really believe V6 can be as secure as V4. So enforce the features you already have for V4 and V6, but you also need to protect your network against V6 specific attacks. For example, route advertisements. Somebody can inject a router on your network and start advertising the network prefix so that you can put a mean in the middle attack. So a common protection against this will be RA guard, where you filter those messages and allow this only from the just specific ports of your router ports. And
so this is like, you know, for switch control, you would do, you can do things like dynamic ARP inspection. You can do things like IP source guard, where you're filtering on a port so that, again, to prevent against various kinds of man in the middle attacks. You don't want someone pretending to play a role that you don't want them to play. Router advertisement, meaning, hey, I'm a router, I can forward for you, here's the prefix you want to use, and then you can communicate with me, and I can forward your traffic on to other parts of the network. Right, so if he's one that's not supposed to do that, man-in-the-middle attack, so you filter off those router advertisements, where they're except from the ports where they're supposed to be showing up.
Exactly. I'd like to add, especially for the listeners who come in and may not be familiar, kind of what we're talking about is router advertisement. Very critical and very crucial in the operations of V6 is that clients don't get told about their default gateway either through a static config or through DHCP. It's this new thing that the router does on a V6 router interface. It sends out this advertisement. We've mentioned it, the router advertiser. And within that is basically a flag that's set to tell the client, I am a V6 router that you can use. And we don't have that in V4. And so that's kind of why we're spending a little bit extra time here talking about this particular feature and this function, is because we need to protect it. We're used to these ARP protections. We're used to DHCP-type spoofing protections. And we have all of those same things that you have to also configure in V6. But that router advertisement's a little bit different animal than anything else that we've ever had. And so we need that extra protection. One thing I will say, again, kind of for the audience, is that not all router products have the RA guard feature. And so you have to implement it more like an ACL, you know, a set of rules and ACEs and an ACL to get the same basic capability, where that you say, I only want router advertisements to come into this port. You know, that's my trusted router interface.
What other security concerns might we have in IPv6 that by default we should really be, you know, trying to prevent or be concerned about if we're building out our IPv6 environment?
I think Guilherme said it most correct. Is whatever you do for V4, you need to do the counterpart to V6. You just have to be careful, especially if it's in ACLs and firewall rules, that you don't inadvertently block a particular protocol function that's actually needed. Because there are a few that are different in V6 than in V4, where you could do kind of like blanket blocks of things. You can't always do that with V6.
And it's worth pointing out that there's plenty of known attacks against IPv6 specifically. No matter how immature IPv6 implementations might be in various applications and pieces of software, there's plenty of activity in the Black Hat security community to go after IPv6 and be able to exploit it. And so, yeah, if you deploy IPv6, you need to be aware of what the security concerns are and get out in front of that in the same mindset you had with IPv4.
And one thing that the guys should be aware of is that maybe you also need to deploy V6 security even on non-V6 enabled environments, because as we discussed, Windows 7 comes with V6 enabled by default. And if it gets a RI advertisement on the network, it will try to access the network using that router advertisement. So maybe even on non-V6 enabled environments, you need a RA guard on your switches. So take care of that.
Okay, so one final question as we kind of bring this to the end here. Resources. What have you found in your IPv6 homework, whether that's online resources or specific books or blog posts that you would like to recommend to the audience? Jeff, why don't we start with you? I suspect you have a lot.
Well, can I give a shameless plug?
Oh, by all means.
I was part of an author team on a book called The Guide to TCP/IP, and specifically the fourth edition. And it was largely a book by a couple industry notables, Ed Tittle and Laura Chapel, that was predominantly V4, and their last third edition had like 50 pages out of 800 that were V6. Hmm. And so part of the whole V4 book, or fourth edition rather, was to make it I call it dual stack book. It's a 50-50. You had mentioned our good friend Ed Horley. He's got a great book, Practical IPv6 for Windows Administrators.
I've got it on my shelf, yeah.
Focuses on Windows 8 and Windows 2012 Server. And Ed did a little bit different take on it. He did both command line and GUI. And so it's certainly great for a Windows environment, but it's also just a really good V6 book. There's a few others. There's a V6 addressing book that just came out, V6 Address Planning, that Tom Coffeen did, published through O'Reilly. IPv6 Essentials by Sylvia Hagen. She just updated that last year. There's Understanding IPv6 by Joe Davies, who worked for Microsoft, and he was part of the very early IPv6 team. And so it's, again, a good reference, has a little bit of a Microsoft slant to it, but it's a good reference. There's IPv6 Security by Cisco Press that Eric Vink and Scott Hogue did. It's a little older than some of the other books, but it's still relevant because it's talking about foundational security things. Of course, has a Cisco slant, but because Eric works for Cisco and Scott, a big Cisco integrator. There's a few other books that are out on the market. One of the things that I do caution folks is that there's like three timelines of book publications. There's the late 90s, early 2000s as the protocol was introduced. There's kind of like that middle 2000s, and then maybe the later 2009, 2010, 2012 range. They're all relative, but the newer books are closer to the newer RFC updates. All kinds of different blog posts. It's one of those things, if you do good searching, just do a little searching on V6, most of the manufacturers have decent documentation that go into their capabilities and sometimes scenario usage, of it. Finally, the last resource that I recommend to folks is the IPv6 Forum, which is kind of a global nonprofit entity that kind of keeps track of all the V6 things that are going on, as well as they have the only industry certifications that are out there for V6.
And one resource that I like to use is the Cisco Live videos, because even if you didn't attend Cisco Live, you're able to watch the recording of many sessions, and they have plenty of really good library of IPv6 related sessions on there, going from addressing all the way to security, and I use those, and they're very good resources.
Yeah, I'll put in my vote behind that as well. Cisco particularly, they've of networking vendors, they are one of the ones that have been right out in front with IPv6 and working towards, you know, integration and availability and supporting IPv6 for customers and such. So, yeah, and the Cisco Live content is fabulous and free. You just register and go for the vast majority of the sessions are free. Just go get them.
Absolutely. I will also throw my hat on that ring, too, because they are good. And I think this year, the Cisco Live US, it just happened a few weeks ago, I think it was to the point that there were more V6 sessions available than one individual could attend. You could do your entire week of Cisco Live in V6 and not get them all.
My understanding is that philosophically, within the Cisco Live presentation community, is that they're just trying to mainline IPv6 right into content as well, where it isn't even necessarily specific IPv6 sessions you go attend. You can just expect to see IPv6 content in whatever session you go to if addressing is a particularly significant part of whatever the content is.
I think I've heard that as well, and that's where it should be. I mean, it's various comments that go on between some of the folks that follow this, you know, on a daily basis, even in Twitter. You know, people say, oh, such and such has got V6. And it's like, why are we even having to mention that anymore? It should not only be the standard. It should be, oh, we can't do this in V4 anymore. You know, that's where it ought to be. It's just not there yet.
Well, guys, why don't we bring this Packet Pushers podcast to an end? And one final question for each of you is, again, more shameless plugs and so on. Do you guys have Twitter handles or blogs or anything that related to that folks could follow you? And, Jeff, let's start with you.
Well, I do have a Twitter at JeffCarroll_V6, and I'm relatively active, well, daily active on that. And I tend to kind of stick more to the V6 conversations. I don't actually have a blog yet, although at some point I would like to be talking with you, Mr. Ethan, about some of that.
I think we have a site that maybe we can help you out with that.
Well, I'm hoping we could. I most of my stuff is just kind of I do a lot of comment. I would say that between probably the Cisco and Juniper kind of like support boards, there's V6 conversations that are starting to go on, and I follow those just to see what people are doing and the problems that people are running into, and tend to comment where I can on some of those. So there are just a few good resources. Ed Horley has a good blog at How Funky. I think it's howfunky.com, isn't it? InfoBlox has a good group known as the IPv6 Center of Excellence, and they have not only about four or five of their own folks that post, but Ed Horley posts, Scott Hogue posts on there as well. They're part of that Center of Excellence team. So those are my predominant, I would say, online things that I watch on a daily basis.
Yeah, Ed's site is howfunky.com. Exactly right. I just double-checked it in the browser to make sure. Guillermo, how about you?
Well, folks can find me at JOWGoes at Twitter. And, well, I still don't have a blog yet, but maybe I'm trying to write some posts on Packet Pushers in the near future.
Well, thanks to both of you for coming on the show and sharing your time. It took us a while to actually get this recording date on the calendar, but we worked it out, and it was a great show. I really appreciate the input and all the thoughts shared with the audience. And one more time, I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. EthanCBanks.com is my blog. And, of course, this has been the Packet Pushers podcast. For this show, which is the weekly show, and other shows, we've got several channels going now up at PacketPushers.net, like Priority Queue, We're experimenting with some new shows. One of them is Citizens of Tech, which is more entertaining and a little bit lighthearted, just kind of something fun to listen to if you're nerdy and like weird things. Citizens of Tech might be fun for you. The Data Nut Show, which I have just launched with Chris Wall, which is less networking and more data center focused. If you're a data center infrastructure engineer and want to hear broader topics than just networking, Chris and I will be talking about those things on Data Nuts. And, of course, the Network Break Show, which we do news and analysis with Drew Conray Murray and Greg Farrow and myself. Thanks for listening to the show today. If you have any comments about this show or questions, you can send them to us via Twitter at PacketPushers or email packetpushers@gmail.com. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.